Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast where we bring you the cutting edge of surgical science and technique. In this episode, our MIS team will take on common bile duct explorations, reviewing key papers that have shaped our approach to colidocal lithiasis from our first forays in laparoscopic exploration to new and bona fide robotic options. I'm Shana Eckhouse, Associate Professor of Surgery, Medical Director of Bariatric Surgery, and Vice Chair of Clinical Operations for the Department of Surgery here at Duke. And I'm joined today with Dr. James Jung, Assistant Professor of Surgery, Dr. Zachary Weitzner, our Minimally Invasive and Bariatric Surgery Fellow, and Dr. Joey Lev, one of our surgical residents. Joey, get us started.
Awesome. Let's dive right in. Historically, the purview of both endoscopists and surgeons, colidocal lithiasis has increasingly been tackled in single-stage interventions. We do the cholecystectomy, we get rid of the duct stones, and we obviate the need for another intervention. When unsuccessful, ERCP remains an option, but how do we get here? In 1999, a prospective cohort study came out in JAMA Surgery called Laparoscopic Common Bile Duct Exploration Long-Term Outcome. Patients with colidocal lithiasis that underwent LAP Common Bile Duct Exploration, or LAP-CBDE, were followed with surveys over an average of 5 years on pain, retained stones, and other symptoms. The rate of failure was exceedingly low, 3%, and retained stones were found in just one patient of the 116 that returned the surveys, but it's still taken time to come into vogue.
When I started practicing, we already knew that LAP-CBDE was effective, but the norm was still to do the COLE first and ERCP second. It was the exception, not the rule, to do it this way. In fact, my practice pattern since becoming an attending has been to not do IOC because I don't enjoy doing it. With time, that has changed because of my primary specialty in metabolic and bariatric surgery, where we have to consider IOC in every patient with surgically altered anatomy.
Yeah, she does. You know, I think you and I are contemporary in when we trained, and during the time, you know, I don't think LAP CBD exploration was that common or commonly taught. I think the usual practice had been, you know, if there's high preoperative suspicions for CBD stone, that it would be ERCP first and then perform laparoscopic cholecystectomy. Or you do laparoscopic cholecystectomy, you have intraoperative findings that are suspicious for CBD stone. Either you do an intraoperative cholangiogram and find the stone, but even when you find the stone, it's not that you would jump into a laparoscopic CBD exploration, but to stop and then, you know, send to GI for ERCP. So that was kind of the usual pattern, at least during kind of our contemporary time. But certainly we're seeing more and more emergence of surgeons performing laparoscopic CBD exploration effectively, and this becoming more commonplace with advent of new technologies and so forth. Zach, this paper was published in 1999. So after this initial paper demonstrating efficacy of this technique, what came next?
So after we've proven the efficacy of the treatment, the natural next step was then to compare it to the existing treatment, which, as you guys both mentioned, was ERCP. And so in 2019, there was a meta-analysis that was published in Surgical Endoscopy that included 12 randomized controlled trials. And this study looked at ERCP followed by LAP COLE in a staged fashion, like you guys were talking about, and compared it to LAP COLE with simultaneous LAP common bile duct exploration. The study revealed a significantly higher rate of pancreatitis in the group that underwent ERCP, and both an increased rate of bile leak and poorer stone clearance in the LAP common bile duct exploration group. Length of stay was also shorter in the single stage group, and mortality was the same between these two groups.
Yeah, so our first study was published in 1999, and then this meta-analysis was published 20 years later. It's obviously accumulated enough RCTs to demonstrate this. But during that time, a lot of the LAP-CBD exploration techniques are not we perform these days. Right now, we a lot of the times rely on the transistic approach, but in the previous one, there might have been the common bile duct approach to exploration and might have included using T-tubes and things like that that resulted in higher bile leak rates. Those are something that we should keep in mind when we look at this evidence because the techniques have evolved over the years.
Now, it's interesting, too, when you look at the actual RCTs included, the more recent studies found equivalent clearance rates. It's possible that comfort and adoption of LAP-CBDE or technology has just improved. It's important, though, to take a beat here and describe the difference between transcystic bile duct exploration and transcholodochal exploration. Earlier papers used a transcholodochal approach where they make an incision onto the common bile duct between the blood supply in a longitudinal fashion to clear the duct in a couple different ways, either using typically a Fogarty balloon or a sphincteroplasty or a nitinol stent extraction in a basket. And then you close the bile duct over a T-tube, which I've done a few times and is not fun to do. I've done it laparoscopically with the help of a HPB surgeon and learns that I don't love managing T-tubes. They contribute to higher bile leaks and more complications, wound issues. Transitioning to these transcystic bile duct explorations has been, I think, impactful not only to my desire to adopt the technique, but also to the outcomes of the patient.
Definitely. And the differences between transcystic and transcholodochal bile duct exploration has been studied. There's a 2019 meta-analysis that was published in British Journal of Surgery that looked at 25 studies that examined this topic and found that while transcholodochal common bile duct exploration had a higher rate of duct clearance than transcystic approaches, the transcystic exploration yielded shorter duration of surgery, lower bile duct leak rates, and shorter length of stay, with no difference in conversion, stricture formation, or reintervention. Transcystic exploration is possible in patients with a cystic duct greater than 3 millimeters, cystic ducts without angulations that would impede passage of a cholecystoscope, ducts with small stones that are less than 8 millimeters, and those that are located distal to the cystic duct takeoff. For stones that are large, those that are proximal to the cystic duct takeoff, or in patients whose cystic duct geometry is not favorable to exploration, a transcholodochal exploration is necessary. So Dr. Eckhouse, given the evolution in the practice of common bile duct exploration, what's your current practice right now?
That's a great question. There's so many new technologies that are coming out that are really fancy and cool to play with, like the spyglass scope that is a digital cholecystoscope scope that has all the accoutrement needed to clear stone. It has a great setup. I have actually, while I love that, for some of my smaller ducts and patients who have sludge and not stone and don't have obstructing physiology, I'll actually do a transcystic wire-guided sphincteroplasty, which was taught to me by my fellow when I was at my previous institution, Maggie Bosley, who's now in practice at OHSU in Portland, Oregon. And my goal is typically to get a 5 French ureteral catheter down because I know I can put a wire down it. And if I put a wire down it, then I can seldinger out the catheter and put in either a angioplasty balloon, or I can do spyglass, and gives me all the options after I fire a cholangiogram. And I find changing from the kind of standard 4 French to a 5 French catheter has been hugely impactful to my efficiency in the operating room. And the other things that I've learned with trying these different technologies with the scope and then using a little older but cheaper technique is port placement becomes really important. And so all these have really evolved me to being primarily a balloon sphincteroplasty surgeon for clearing the common bile duct. And if that doesn't work or there are larger stones, then I will bring via Seldinger technique the spyglass scope.
Thanks so much for sharing about your practice. It's interesting to note that every individual surgeon's practice and how they handle these issues is quite different. And that's made studying the outcomes after these procedures quite difficult. It's worth noting that the quality of the randomized controlled trials that have explored transcystic versus transcholodochal common duct exploration is quite low. There's very few robust trials in this area. Why do you think this is the case, Dr. Jung?
Yeah, Zach, that's a really important point. High-quality randomized controlled trials comparing transcystic and transcholodochal approaches are quite limited, and I think it's largely because of the practical and ethical challenges of performing surgical research. You know, these procedures are highly operator-dependent based on their training, where they are, availability of the devices, and case selection often dictates the approach. It's about case selection. For example, smaller stones distal to the takeoff in a dilated cystic duct that's not angulated are far better suited for transcystic exploration, whereas the other ones, you have to depend on transcholodochal approach. It's really hard to randomize to two very different approaches. Randomizing patients irrespective of these anatomic or technical factors risks poor outcomes and surgeon non-equipoise. In addition, the relatively low incidence of cholodochal lithiasis and hard to do a lot of these operations, stack them up in a day where you could get study coordinators to do randomization and all this stuff. The low incidence requiring exploration makes it really difficult for single centers to achieve adequate sample sizes. The result, most evidence has come from retrospective, prospective cohort studies or relatively poorly performed randomized trials.
Today's episode of the Behind the Knock podcast is brought to you by our presenting sponsor, Gore Medical Products Division. When it comes to ventral hernia repair in high BMI and comorbid patients, strength matters. Gore Synacor biomaterial is a permanent mesh that is built like a lightweight, with the strength of a heavyweight, and has zero reported mesh fractures. With a less than 1% recurrence rate in ventral hernia working group grade 1 and 2 patients, and a low rate of infection, Synacor is designed to support your complex ventral hernia repairs. Visit goremedical.com/BTKpod to learn more and ask your Gore representative about sizing and availability. Gore Synacor biomaterial, no compromise for your high BMI and comorbid patients. Intended for U.S. audiences only, Gore is a financial sponsor of this podcast, which has been independently developed by the presenters and does not constitute medical advice from Gore. Always consult the instructions for use prior to using any medical device.
In April of this year, a review came out called Reclaim the Duct, Laparoscopic Common Bile Duct Exploration for the Acute Care Surgeon. Now, obviously, a lot of acute cholecystitis and colitis, cholangitis, gallstone pancreatitis falls under the purview of an acute care surgeon. About 10 to 15% of the patients coming in with acute cholecystitis have colitis. The review cites lower overall costs, reduced length of stay, reduced post-op bleeding, and less pancreatitis as reasons to pursue a single-stage approach, and includes a range of technical tips, including keeping knowledgeable partners nearby and not underestimating the learning curve. It's also true that if you bail out, a patient can still get an ERCP. I found this review pretty compelling as a trainee interested in MIS ACS. What do you all think about broader adoption?
I'm really glad you picked this article, partly because I know the senior author really well. Matt Martin is not only an MIS surgeon, but he's an ACS surgeon. So it actually lends to your interest really well, especially considering advanced GI endoscopy is not available everywhere. Having surgeons in the acute care space being able to clear the duct in a single stage saves the patient time and a potential transfer and risk, as we've discussed. Despite the fact that I think being able to do on-commit cholecystectomy and common bile duct exploration is the way of the future, there are times when we really need to consider ERCP first. And these are for our patients with acute cholangitis or pancreatitis, where we need them to have time to heal from the acute inflammatory process that has occurred with their etiology. Once they're clinically stable, then they're ready for cholecystectomy. These are patients that I wouldn't want to do as a single stage approach myself, or I wouldn't encourage acute care surgery to do either.
Yeah. First of all, I think there's increasing role for general surgeons, ACS surgeons to play a role. In fact, Denise G at Mass General and I wrote a opinion piece in the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery a few years ago about the management of colitis and just around the role of increasing role of the general surgeon to clear out the duct in this single stage approach. But one thing that I would also really advocate for is that you should know when to bail. You should really know when to stop and know that you have great partners in GI to perform ERCP postoperatively. So for me, I was never trained in transcolidocal approach to CBD exploration. So if my transcystic approach fails, then I'm not going to attempt to do transcolidocal approach for CBD exploration because that's beyond my expertise, that's beyond my training. I would say in that way, you just have to know where the limitations are and know when to talk to your partners. If you have a partner who knows how to do transcolidocal approach, or if you don't have that available, then you communicate this with a GI colleague and they could perform ERCP postoperatively.
I think all that makes so much sense to me and reminds me that I get to operate on some patients with a little bit different anatomy where the bailouts have to be a little bit different than just going to an ERCP. So while I agree with you, I don't like doing a transcolidocal approach. I've done it. The morbidity is high. If I have the option for an ERCP over a transcolidocal approach, I'll probably take it. So in patients with Roux-en-Y anatomy, either after bariatric surgery or another procedure, number one, IOC is super important. And if you find an obstruction or a partial obstruction, I think it's really important to go after it with a common bile duct exploration in a single stage approach. However, there are times when it's not going to work. And I've unfortunately experienced those a couple of times now where I either couldn't get the stones out transcystically or couldn't push them through. And in these situations, my bailout is number one, call GI and see if they're able to come into the OR at the time and do a transgastric ERCP on table. And if that doesn't work, leaving a feeding tube in a patient with a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass in the excluded or distal stomach can be a very helpful approach, allowing that to mature and GI can come back and fight another day. The other maneuver or technique that can be used or instrument that can be used, it's not traditionally talked about, is something called a Finelli stent, which is something you can leave across the sphincter and ampulla to allow a path for bile to drain, and GI can come back and pull that out when they do an ERCP in the future if you're not able to completely clear the duct. Not every place has Finelli stents, and they're not the easiest to place, but you place them under fluoro. Ultimately, something you can use as a bailout plan when you're waiting for GI to help you in the future with an ERCP.
It's very interesting to hear about what both Dr. Jung and Dr. Ekas are talking about with the tools that we have, as well as the tools that these studies are mentioning for a different bile duct approaches, like baskets, balloons, lithotripsy, and Finelli stents. Can you guys talk a little bit about what tools we have in our toolboxes to address common bile duct stones? And what do you think that surgeons need to have readily available to clear the duct in most cases? And also, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the role of robotic common bile duct exploration as well.
Great question. I think the first step is always giving glucagon. I have a bit of a different approach maybe than the average. I'll split my glucagon dosing from the beginning of the case. I start to get things to relax and then give a dose within the 5 to 10 minutes of doing my common bile duct exploration. And then giving that time to percolate, I'll do a large flush, typically 20 to 40 cc's. If a flush doesn't work, then my next step is typically to do a wire-guided balloon sphincteroplasty. And I will pick my balloon based on the diameter of the common bile duct. And it'll be anywhere between 6 and 10 millimeters on average with a length of 40 millimeters. And I use the 75 centimeter catheter length, so it's easy to get over in a Seldinger fashion, my wire. And I'll balloon sphincteroplasty for about 3 to 5 minutes, the ampulla, partly to decrease risk of pancreatitis, but also to get enough trauma to the sphincter and ampulla to get things to drain through. If that doesn't work, then I go down with a basket. And my goal is then to pull each stone out individually with a basket. Typically, I do this, though, using the spyglass. And so if I'm not able to balloon sphincteroplasty, I'll keep the wire down, pull the angioplasty balloon out, bring the spyglass in, and use a basket under direct visualization. And that has worked for me really well for the last 2 years.
Just to address your last question, Zach, you talked about the use of robotic platform. And as we all know, there's been increasing utilization of robotic platform for all types of procedures, including cholecystectomy and common bile duct exploration. There is a published study, a single institution case series of 21 patients that came out just in March in the Journal of Society of Laparoscopic and Robotic Surgeons. In this study, there's 2 of the 21 patients that still needed ERCP postoperatively, but overall the results were encouraging. But this is, again, a case series, single institution, and very limited data. So something to look out for.
Yeah, the authors also mentioned feng shui as a critical component, which I thought was kind of funny, but also very real, because manipulating a C-arm and the robot and all the tools you might need, like Dr. Backhouse mentioned, to do this successfully is no small task.
Yeah, having your staff on the same page, even during a dry run, is really critical. Maybe do a dry run the day before, but the big thing is if you don't have time for that, touch base with your resource nurses, make sure you have everything you need available, and go into the operating room before the patient rolls back and touch base with your team. Make sure they have all the equipment you think you could need. Think outside the box, go down that path and make sure all of it's in the room so that they're set up for success. And then I think talking to the staff about not only what you expect to go well, but what you're concerned about and what you think you're going to need to do really helps them navigate what the steps were going to be in the moment. Now, obviously, you wouldn't do the duct exploration robotically if you were doing your cholecystectomy laparoscopically, and a 2023 JAMA surgery paper, Comparative Safety of Robotic-Assisted versus Laparoscopic Cholecystectomy, looked at just over 1 million patients and found that though robot use has increased 37-fold since 2010, it's still only about 150,000 of those million.
And interestingly, in that paper, robotic-assisted cholecystectomy had a higher rate of common bile duct injury than lap chole at 0.7% compared to 0.2%, which could be due to a number of different factors, possibly related to robot learning curve or some other unknown factors that we're not able to yet appreciate. I think that one of the most important things is that robotic surgery has opened a platform that allows us to do open style procedures on patients in a MIS fashion that we weren't necessarily able to do as easily laparoscopically. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts, Dr. Jung, about how the robotic platform will translate to transcholecystectomy exploration.
Yeah, I think as it was highlighted in that landmark paper in JAMA Surgery, just looking at the short-term outcomes, safety outcomes of robot versus lap cholecystectomy. Again, cholecystectomy is a relatively simpler procedure that we commonly perform. But just by changing the platform, we're seeing a at least statistically significant and somewhat clinically significant difference in postoperative outcomes. And I think really the reason for that is we tend to underestimate the learning curve that's involved in transitioning from lap to robot, or for some people, open to robot. And that's something that should be taken very seriously. When deciding to perform a procedure that you know how to do in one platform and transitioning to another platform, especially if the procedure is as complex as common bile duct exploration that involves different types of devices concurrent to the new device of robotic platform that you're using, you really need to, you know, make sure that you get enough adequate training support, not only for yourself as a surgeon, but also your perioperative team that involves your scrub tech, your circulating nurses, your assistants, anesthesiologists, because otherwise it's very hard to coordinate all of these together. And for me, I think it's really, you know, you as a surgeon is just overburdened with cognitive load of trying to deal with all different moving pieces of doing all of this together at once. And that increased cognitive load may lead to and translate to worse clinical outcomes. So be really careful when you're transitioning to a new platform. Be aware of the learning curve, the steep learning curve that's involved. Don't underestimate it.
Yeah, these are really important points. And as I think about the learning curve, I'm thinking about the learning curve both for common bile duct exploration and for robotic surgery, which I've done both now. And marrying them together is something you really want to be cautious of. I didn't learn common bile duct exploration as a trainee. I learned it in practice my second year out. And I still remember making sure the first time running through everything, just like we've talked about with the team ahead of time, but also with one of my partners and having a partner available to help me. Even though everything went well, my two partners were there, one learning and one teaching, just to make sure we crossed our T's and dot our I's and made sure the patient was safe and successful. I've adopted that also with my robotic journey as well, even though I do both. And so understanding how to adopt common bile duct exploration can be different for you. One of the best things that has been helpful for me is having somebody I can call after each common bile duct exploration to talk through what went well, what were my opportunities, and how I could change to improve my efficiency and success has been really helpful with moving forward with some of the newer techniques and adoptions that I've been able to make. Overall, I think the learning curve of surgeons taking back the common bile duct is a fascinating one that we're watching in evolution right now. This has been an overview of surgical management from our perspective of cholecystectomy lithiasis from your MIS team. We hope you've had fun. Look forward to seeing you next time. Now get your cholecystoscope ready and dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.